Hello, you're with Helen with the Talk and Information Center Network, with readings from Wired. This article is a continuation of last time. Scientists thought Parkinson's was in our genes. It might be in the water. David Ferry, source Wired. In 1982, 2 years before Lindbergh was stationed at Camp Lejeune, a 42-year-old heroin addict named George Carrillo was wheeled into the Santa Clara Valley Medical Center in San Jose, California. A few days earlier, Carrillo had been perfectly able-bodied. Now he was mute and unable to move. Baffled, the neurologist on call came to an impossible diagnosis. The patient, over a long weekend, had developed Parkinson's disease. Carrillo would probably have spent the rest of his short life in a psych ward had a pioneering young neurologist named Bill Langston not intervened. The way Parkinson's takes over the body is distinct, Langston told me. The disease attacks the neurons in a region of the brain called the substantia nigra, a small dark structure that stands out amid the squirms of beige. The neurons here release dopamine, which sends signals to other neurons that help the body to move smoothly and effectively. In Parkinson's, these neurons die off. By the time a patient is diagnosed, they have often lost 60 to 80% of them. The process usually takes years, Langston says, but in the case of Carrillo, all the neurons had disappeared almost overnight. Over the summer of 1982, Langston found five more frozen addicts across the Bay Area. Through gumshoe detective work, he discovered they had all injected a batch of what they believed to be a designer drug called MPPP, cooked in a Morgan Hill basement. But the chemistry had gone awry. Instead of a 1-methyl-1-4-phenylephrine-1-4-propionoxypyridine, a potent opiate with morphine-like effects, the dimebag chemist had accidentally made 1-methy-1-4-phenyl-1-1-2-3-6-tetrahydrofyridine, or MPTP, a pharmacological slip-up that would rewrite neurology textbooks. When Langston and colleagues secured a batch of MPTP and tested it on primates, they knew they had uncorked a revolution. Any neurologist could see these monkeys and immediately know that it's Parkinson's, Langston says, which was especially compelling since monkeys do not get Parkinson's in the wild. In a first, Langston showed that MPTP killed the dopamine-producing neurons in monkeys' substantia nigra. The discovery made him the most famous Parkinson's researcher in the country, and Langston wrote at the time, promised to turn the entire field of Parkinson's disease upside down. Parkinson's, it appeared, could be caused by a chemical. Amy Lindbergh settled quickly into life at Lejeune. She played tennis and ran on her lunch breaks, flitting through sprinklers in the turgid Carolina summers. But something dark was lurking beneath her feet. Sometime before 1953, a massive plume of trichlorethylene, or TCE, had entered the groundwater beneath Camp Lejeune. TCE is a highly effective solvent, one of those mid-century wonder chemicals that vaporizes quickly and dissolves whatever grease it touches. The spill's source is debated, but grunts on base used TCE to maintain machinery, and the dry cleaner sprayed it on dress blues. It was ubiquitous at Lejeune and all over America. And TCE appeared benign, too. You could rub it on your hands or huff its fumes and feel no immediate effects. It plays the longer game. For approximately 35 years, Marines and sailors who lived at Lejeune unknowingly breathed in vaporized TCE whenever they turned on their tap. The Navy, which oversees the Marine Corps, first denied the toxic plume's existence, then refused to admit it could affect Marines' health. But as Lejeune's vets aged, cancers and unexplained illness began stalking them at staggering rates. Marines stationed on base had a 35% higher risk of developing kidney cancer, a 47% higher risk of Hodgkin's lymphoma, a 68% higher risk of multiple myeloma. At the local cemetery, the section reserved for infants had to be expanded. Meanwhile, Langston had spent the remainder of the 1980s setting up the California Parkinson's Foundation, later renamed the Parkinson's Institute, a lab and treatment facility equipped with everything needed to finally reveal the cause of the disease. "We thought we were going to solve it," Langston told me. Researchers affiliated with the Institute created the first animal model for Parkinson's, identified a pesticide called paraquat as a near chemical match to MPTP, and proved that farm workers who sprayed paraquat developed Parkinson's at exceedingly high rates. Then they showed that identical twins developed Parkinson's at the same rate as fraternal twins, something that wouldn't make sense if the disease were purely genetic, since identical twins share DNA and fraternal twins do not. They even noted TCE as a potential cause of the disease, Langston says. Each revelation, the team thought, represented another nail in the coffin of the genetic theory of Parkinson's. But there was a problem. The Human Genome Project had launched in 1990, promising to usher in a new era of personalized medicine. The project's goal to identify all of the genes in man was radical, and by the time it was completed in 2000, frothy comparisons to the moon landing were frequent. Unraveling our genome would revolutionize the diagnosis, prevention, and treatment of most, if not all, human diseases, then-President Bill Clinton said. But for Langston and his colleagues, the Human Genome Project sucked the air out of the environmental health space. Genetics became the 800-pound gorilla, as one scientist put it. "All the research dollars went toward genetics," says Sam Goldman, who worked with Langston on the twin study. "It's just a lot sexier than epidemiology. It's the latest gadget, the bigger rocket. A generation of young scientists were being trained to think of genetics and genomics as the default place to look for answers. I characterize science as a bunch of five-year-olds playing soccer," says another researcher. "They all go where the ball is, running around the field in a herd. And the ball was decidedly not environmental health. Donors want a cure," Langston says, "and they want it now." In 1997, researchers found a family in Italy that had passed along Parkinson's disease for generations. Although the gene in question would later be known to cause just a fraction of Parkinson's cases, the damage was done. The Parkinson's Institute faced stronger economic headwinds and difficulties with administration, and Langston eventually chose to shut it down. The environmental theory of Parkinson's went back on the shelf. No one knows exactly how much of the world's drinking water is laced with TCE. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reckons that the water supply of between 4 and 18% of Americans is contaminated, although not always at dangerous concentrations. The Environmental Working Group figures 17 million Americans drink the stuff. In Silicon Valley, where TCE was integral to the manufacturing of early transistors, a necklace of underground plumes had been identified along Highway 101 from Palo Alto to San Jose. Santa Clara County has more toxic Superfund sites at 23 than any other county in the country. Several tech giants have offices near or on top of these sites. In 2013, workers at a Google office were subjected to unhealthy levels of TCE for months after a ventilation system failed. And while TCE's connection to cancer is well studied, what it does to our brain is more mysterious. That's because good data on exposure is devilishly hard to come by. The U.S., with its fractious healthcare system, has few national databases, and chemical exposures are rarely tracked. In 2017, Sam Goldman realized that Camplagine offered the perfect opportunity to change this. Goldman, an epidemiologist and a doctor, has made a career out of teasing apart data, finding unusual case reports, looking for patterns, interviewing patients in the clinic about what chemicals they handled at old jobs and what exposures they faced in their childhood. In the case of Lejeune, Goldman could examine VA medical records to find Parkinson's diagnosis and compare them to service records. But Goldman's genius wasn't finding this Lejeune cohort. It was realizing he had a control group, too. Camp Pendleton in Southern California is the Marine Corps' West Coast equivalent to Lejeune. Thousands of young, healthy Marines shuffle through its barbed wire gates each year. But Pendleton has one thing Lejeune does not: uncontaminated drinking water. When Goldman compared both populations, the results were shocking. Marines exposed to TCE at Lejeune were 70% more likely to have Parkinson's than those stationed at Pendleton. And in a follow-up study last year, he showed that disease progression in Lejeune vets with the highest exposure to TCE was faster than those with low or no exposure too. In the world of Parkinson's research, Goldman's study was a blockbuster. But to really prove a link, you need more than just correlation. So, on the third floor of a drab university building in Birmingham, Alabama, Brianna de Miranda has recreated Camp Lejeune in her lab, but for mice. De Miranda is a toxicologist, not a neurologist, which is an unusual CV for a cutting-edge Parkinson's researcher. When I visit her in October 2024, she shows me the plexiglass chamber where a few dozen mice doze in a pile. They've been spending their days in this chamber for months, inhaling a small amount of TCE almost every day. This experiment is the first to recreate the exposure someone like Lindbergh experienced over years at Camp Lejeune. D. Miranda walks into a dark annex of her lab and asks a tech to pull up some imagery. These are dopamine neurons in the brain, D. Miranda says, pointing to a scan of the control mice. In unexposed mice, the substantia nigra looks like a nighttime satellite image of Manhattan, thousands of neurons sending dopamine across the mice's brains to orchestrate fluid scurrying and sniffing and munching. Then the tech pulls up the brain scans of mice who have been exposed to TCE. Suddenly, we're in West Virginia. It's not pitch black, but most of the lights are off, and the ones that remain have been dimmed. The dopamine neurons have died, De Miranda explains, and she's seeing the physical effects in the mice, too. We see minor motion defects. We see it in their gait, and we are seeing cognitive effects, De Miranda says. De Miranda studies, the first ever on inhaled TCE toxicity and Parkinson's, are compelling, her colleagues agree, and well-designed. And although there is more work to be done, the results wrap a bow on Goldman's epidemiological work and the Parkinson's Institute's years of research. TCE is a neurotoxin, and generations of Americans have been exposed. In December 2024, the Environmental Protection Agency finally moved to ban TCE in the United States. I think TCE is the most important cause of Parkinson's in the U.S., says Ray Dorsey, the Parkinson's expert at the University of Rochester. In 2021, Dorsey, who frequently collaborates with Dee Miranda Goldman and a core group of like-minded scientists, published Ending Parkinson's Disease. The book's central thesis, Parkinson's is a growing pandemic, and up to 90% of cases are caused by chemicals in our environment, cut exposures like TCE and pesticides, and we can end Parkinson's as we know it. The full effect of the Parkinson's pandemic, Dorsey writes, is not inevitable, but to a large extent preventable. Since the 1990s, the number of Americans with chronic disease has ballooned to more than 75% of adults, per the CDC. Autism, insulin resistance, and autoimmune diagnoses have reached epidemic proportions. The incidence of cancer in people under the age of 50 has hit an all-time high. If Parkinson's disease is, as Ray Dorsey believes, a pandemic that's being caused by environment, it's probably not the only one. After a century of putting genetics on a pedestal, the geneticists have some surprising news for us. The vast majority of chronic disease isn't caused by our genes. The Human Genome Project was a $3 billion investment. And what did we find out? Says Thomas Hartung, a toxicologist at Johns Hopkins, 5% of all disease is purely genetic. Less than 40% of diseases even have a genetic component. Most of the conditions we worry about instead stem from a complex interaction between our genes and our environment. Genetics loads the gun, as former National Institutes of Health head Francis Collins put it, but the environment pulls the trigger. Then, rather than revealing the genetic origins of disease, genomics has done the opposite. Only 10% of breast cancer cases are purely genetic. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, rheumatoid arthritis, coronary heart disease, all hover around 20%. The primary driver of disease is considerably more terrestrial. It's the environment, stupid. Yet, only 1% of the roughly 350,000 chemicals in use in the United States have ever been tested for safety. In its 55-year history, the EPA has banned or restricted about a dozen. By contrast, the EU has banned more than 2,000. Paraquat, the pesticide that appears to cause Parkinson's in farm workers, has been banned in Europe and China, but remains available in the U.S. And in January, a month after the EPA's ban on TCE was finalized, the Trump administration moved to undo it, even as new evidence emerged of Parkinson's clusters in the Rust Belt, where exposure to trichlorothiazide is high. It's easy to mock the MAHAs and the TikTok trad moms making their own food coloring, but the chemical regulatory system of America does not inspire confidence. No one really knows what the chemicals we're interacting with every day are doing to our bodies. That's why earlier this year, slices of brain from Brianna de Miranda's TCE-addled mice ended up with Gary Miller, a professor at Columbia University. Miller is the country's leading proponent of a brand new field called exposomics. Your exposome is the sum of your own personal environmental exposures from the womb to the casket. Many exposures like TCE disappear from the bloodstream quickly. People who came into contact with a chemical in the past will never be able to prove it. The exposome is a way to potentially answer the question, just what the hell have I been exposed to? Miller began his career in the 90s as a Parkinson's researcher studying environmental exposures, but he grew tired of the whack-a-mole approach of modern toxicology, identifying one of the 350,000 chemicals on the market as a potential toxicant, looking for the exposure in the environment, looking for correlations, looking for toxicity in mice's brains, rinse, repeat. He wanted a shotgun approach, an answer to the way genome sequencing identifies all the genes in the body. What Miller wants is a human exposome project. We realized this wasn't just about Parkinson's, he says. There were so many disease states we could look at. Quantify our exposomes, Miller hopes, and we can know what ails us. We have the tools to put the big puzzle together, says Rima Habre, an environmental health and exposomics expert at the University of Southern California. Through blood draws and metabolomic studies, the exposomics advocates what want to measure the vast mixture of chemicals and pollutants in the body and figure out how they impact health. Take air pollution, Aubrey's specialty. An ever-changing melange of small molecules, from tailpipe emissions to tire bits to dust, it has been linked to obesity, endocrine disruption, heart attacks, and more. But if we can figure out what specifically in this toxic cloud is doing the damage, Habre says, we can work to quickly reduce it in our environment, the way we remove lead from gasoline. Or autism. Autism diagnoses have exploded from 1 in 10,000 in the 70s to 1 in 36 today, a rate that genetics and screening can't explain, says John Hopkins' Thomas Hartung. Hartung, another human exposome project proponent, is growing clusters of neurons in the lab and subjecting them to flame-retarding chemicals, which are applied to couches and car seats across America to see what happens. Already, the associations trouble him. The goal of all this, Hartung says, is a world where toxicologists like Brianna de Miranda don't have to spend money creating a mouse gas chamber, expose mice for 3 months, then wait several more months for results. Miller's goal with mice brains is to figure out what exactly about TCEs killing dopamine-producing neurons and leading to Parkinson's, to unravel and define the interaction between our environment and our genetics in a way never before possible. The parallels to the Human Genome Project in both promise and fraud are clear, but there is a sense of empowerment in knowing that our health is not predetermined. Nearly every scientist interviewed for this story does a few simple things. They filter their water. They run an air purifier. They don't microwave plastic. They don't freak out about their daily exposures, but they do things like opt for fragrance-free products, avoid eating out of plastic when they can, and buy organic produce. Our exposures, while not always in our control, can be limited. About 2 hours south of Lejeune in Wilmington, North Carolina, Amy Lindberg is having lunch with her husband, Brad, on a pier overlooking the Atlantic. Although Goldman, Dee Miranda, and Dorsey have unveiled the likely origins of her Parkinson's, the random nature of it gnaws at her. When I was diagnosed, it was just like, where's everyone else? Lindberg says. I felt like, if I have it, what about my co-workers? She nods to Brad, who also spent years drinking Lejeune's water. He suffered no ill consequences, she says. She worries about her kids, one of whom was born on base. She still exercises constantly, playing pickleball, boxing, and hopping on the elliptical. She's found that movement, especially high-intensity exercise, reduces her symptoms. A recent Yale study confirmed as much, showing that interval training increases dopaminergic signals in the brains of Parkinson's patients, suggesting that exercise slows disease progression and even improves neuron function. The environment may have caused Lindberg's disease, but she can use it to fight back. Google's AI overviews can scam you. Here's how to stay safe. David Neal, Source Wired. These days, rather than showing you the traditional list of links when you run a search query, Google is intent on throwing up AI overviews instead, synthesized summaries of information scraped off the web with some word prediction magic added and packaged together in a way to sound as accurate and reliable as possible. We've written before about some of the problems with these AI overviews, which regularly contain mistakes or nonsense, and of course rip off the work of the human writers who actually know the answers to the questions you're putting into Google. There is another problem, though. These AI answers can actually be dangerous. As with every other new technology through history, scams are now making their way into AI overviews as well, apparently injecting Google's AI answers with fraudulent phone numbers that you shouldn't trust. Here's what's happening and how you can make sure you stay safe. How AI overview scams work. Both the Washington Post and Digital Trends have spotted instances of scam support numbers showing up in Google AI overviews, reports of which appeared on Facebook and Reddit, respectively. Credit unions and banks are also warning their customers about these scams. It doesn't seem to be a completely new problem, but the way Google search works now, it's been given a new twist. Here's what happens. The unfortunate victim Googles a company name looking for a contact number, then calls the number thrown up by AI. This doesn't actually lead to the company in question, but rather to someone pretending to be that company, who then tries to take payment information or other sensitive details from the caller. It's not clear exactly how these fake numbers are being planted, but the best guess is that they're being published in multiple low-profile places online, alongside the names of major companies. AI overviews then comes along and scoops them up without running the proper checks to verify the information. The planting of misleading phone numbers by bad actors is not a completely new danger, of course. Misinformation has been a part of the web for a long, long time. But the design of AI overviews, which picks out information from the web and presents it as fact, rather than encouraging you to do the research yourself, is making people much more susceptible to this kind of con. Google says it's actively fighting these scammers and that it's continuing to roll out updates that make its spam detection system stronger. Our anti-spam protections are highly effective at keeping scams out of AI overviews and showing official customer support numbers where possible, the company said in the statement to Wired. Of course, it's not just happening on Google search. Security researchers have shown how malicious text can be hidden in emails and presumably documents as well, which is then scraped and summarized by the AI and served up to the user, who takes it as accurate and authentic. The issue is also showing up in other AI search engines. How to keep yourself safe? The advice for avoiding this kind of scam trick is simple. Don't believe everything you read in an AI overview, especially not when it comes to specific facts, figures, or phone numbers. Google's AI technology is susceptible to picking up outdated or suspect information from the web as well as accurate data. And given the way the AI overview interface is presented, it's difficult to tell the difference. If you're looking for a contact phone number or something similar, run a search for the company you're trying to get in touch with, then use the details on the company's own website. It may be an extra click or two, but it's worth it to make sure you're dealing with correct contact information. Caution is still required wherever you get your information from, though, especially when it comes to dealing with customer service representatives and discussing anything to do with payments or personal information. Ideally, you want to verify any number you call with a second Google search for it. Google recommends this as well. The company says it's recently launched a number of updates to further improve scam protections for AI overview specifically, but it still encourages people to double-check phone numbers by performing additional searches. For now, there's no way to turn off AI overviews. If Google decides to serve them up for your query, all you can do is scroll past them, or maybe switch to a different search engine. Google may be working to remove false phone numbers from results, but we know the nature of generative AI is not to simply parrot information, but to embellish it, which is inevitably going to lead to problems. As our searches become more reliant on AI, it can mean a more natural and conversational user experience, but for some queries, the old ways are the best. So, for example, you might want to chat with Gemini about ideas for your next vacation, but when it comes to actually finding accurate information about hotels, cruise ships, or travel agents, maybe leave AI out of it. Zillow has gone wild for AI. Stephen Levy, Source Wired. This will not be a banner year for the real estate app Zillow. We describe the home market as bouncing along the bottom, CEO Jeremy Waxman said in our conversation this week. Last year was dismal for the real estate market, and he expects things to improve only marginally in 2026. If January's historic drop in home sales is indicative, that even is over-optimistic. The way to think about it is that there were 4.1 million existing homes sold last year. A normal market is 5.5 to 6 million, Waxman says. He hastens to add that Zillow itself is doing better than the real estate industry overall. Still, its valuation is a quarter of its high water mark in 2021. A few hours after we spoke, Waxman announced that Zillow's earnings had increased last quarter. Nonetheless, Zillow's stock price fell nearly 5% the next day. Waxman does see a bright spot, AI. Like every other company in the world, generative AI presents both an opportunity and a risk to Zillow's business. Waxman much prefers to dwell on the upside. We think AI is actually an ingredient rather than a threat, he said on the earnings call. In the last couple years, the LLM revolution has really opened all of our eyes to what's possible, he tells me. Zillow is integrating AI into every aspect of its business, from the way it showcases houses to having agents automate its workflow. Waxman marvels that with Gen AI, you can search for homes near my kids' new school with a fenced-in yard under $3,000 a month. On the other hand, his customers might wind up making those same queries on chatbots operated by OpenAI and Google, and Waxman must figure out how to make their next step a jump to Zillow. In its 20-year history, Zillow celebrated the anniversary this week. The company has always used AI. Waxman, who joined in 2009 and became CEO in 2024, notes that machine learning is the engine behind those Zestimates that gauge a home's worth at any given moment. Zestimates became a viral sensation that helped make the app irresistible. And sites like Zillow Gone Wild, which is also a TV show on the HGTV network, have built a business around highlighting the most intriguing or bizarre listings. More recently, Zillow has spent billions aggressively pursuing new technology. Ongoing effort is up-leveling the presentation of homes for sale. A feature called SkyTour uses an AI technology called Gaussian splatting to turn drone footage into a 3D rendering of the property. I love typing the words Gaussian splatting and can't believe an indie band hasn't adopted it yet. AI also powers a feature inside Zillow's showcase component called virtual staging, which supplies homes with furniture that doesn't really exist. There is risky ground here. Once you abandon the authenticity of an actual photo, the question arises whether you're actually seeing a trustworthy representation of the property. It's important that both buyer and seller understand the line between virtual staging and the reality of a photo, says Waxman. A virtually staged image has to be clearly watermarked and disclosed. He says he's confident that licensed professionals will abide by rules, but as AI becomes dominant, we have to evolve those rules, he says. Right now, Zillow estimates that only a single-digit percentage of its users take advantage of these exotic display features. Particularly disappointing is a foray called Zillow Immerse, which runs on the Apple Vision Pro. Upon rollout in February 2024, Zillow called it the future of home tours. Note that it doesn't claim to be the near future. That platform hasn't yet come to broad consumer prominence, says Waxman of Apple's underperforming innovation. I do think that VR and AR are going to come. Zillow is on more solid ground, using AI to make its own workforce more productive. It's helping us do our job better, says Waxman, who adds that programmers are churning out more code, customer support tasks have been automated, and design teams have shortened timelines for implementing new products. As a result, he says, Zillow has been able to keep its headcount relatively flat. Zillow did cut some jobs recently, but Waxman says that involved a handful of folks that were not meeting a performance bar. Still, the meat of Zillow's business involves searching for homes, and that's where the company may be vulnerable. The problem for Zillow and its competitors is that real estate listings are generally public information. I won't get into ongoing complicated litigation, including lawsuits that Zillow is involved in, regarding how private listings are handled. It's hard enough for Zillow to stay ahead of rivals, but as users increasingly use chatbots as a front end to all sorts of information, it has to worry about customers bypassing its app and going straight to the big LLMs. Zillow moved to stay ahead of this potential shift by becoming one of the first third-party platforms to integrate with OpenAI's platform. But when I used a chatbot to view homes for sale in one Western Massachusetts town, it took a few tries before it surfaced a link to activate the Zillow app. Without that activation, the links to homes for sale were distributed seemingly randomly between Zillow and competitors, homes.com, realtor.com, and so forth. OpenAI is circumspect about what it will do with its newfound power. It's still early, and we continue to learn, says spokesperson Nico Felix, about how the company handles its apps, which isn't quite the same as saying our developers can be 100% sure that we will never compete with them. Even scarier for Zillow is a recent move by the biggest hyperscaler of all, Google. Working with a real estate analytics company called House Canary, the search and AI giant has been experimenting in several cities with putting home listings alongside Google real estate agent ads in search. Click on the link and Google shows its own Zillow-style staging with accompanying critical information like square footage and photo galleries, as well as a link to schedule a viewing with a real estate agent advertising on Google. A Google spokesperson says it's an expansion of its existing real estate agent ads, supplemented with new information to make them more helpful. If the test works out, it's easy to imagine that Google one day might bring the same data to AI products like Gemini. Google does say that the experiment did not involve Gemini, and currently no ads run on the AI model. Predictably, the Google experiment led to yet another dip in Zillow's stock price. It also generated speculation that Google might buy Zillow. Waxman seems oddly sanguine about the nearly $4 trillion behemoth eyeing his business, dismissing Google's experiment as just another way for the company to get more eyeballs and thus increase ad revenue. Sure, they might grab some more marginal ad dollars, he says, but when buyers and sellers want to find a real estate site to use for the transaction, they find us, and that's why so much of our traffic comes direct to us. once you want to consume a virtual tour listing, once you want to get pre-approved, once you want to start messaging with real estate agents, you really need a really deep, integrated experience. Waxman thinks that even in an AI-driven age, its human touch, based on its partnerships with local realtor agencies, will still keep Zillow afloat for its next 20 years. Ideally, we will be helping to allow you to use the Zillow app for everything in the real estate transaction, he explains. That assessment might underestimate how much change is afoot. Maybe AI agents won't replace flesh and blood real estate agents, but it seems likely that the app paradigm, the house Zillow is built on, so to speak, will eventually be supplanted by some sort of omniscient, AI-centric, super factotum, probably powered by corporate giants like Google. How services like Zillow find their way in that paradigm is anything but certain. For now, Waxman's ideal outcome is more prosaic. Maybe we'll get more people to actually move again, he says. A wave of unexplained bot traffic is sweeping the web. Zai Yang, source Wired. For a brief moment in October, Alejandro Quintero thought he had made it big in China. The Bogota-based data analyst owns and manages a website that publishes articles about paranormal activities like ghosts and aliens. The content is written in Spanglish, he says, and was never intended for an Asian audience. But last fall, Quintero's site suddenly began receiving a large volume of visits from China and Singapore. The amount of traffic coming from the two countries was so high and consistent that it now accounts for more than half of total visits to Quintero's site over the past 12 months. When he first noticed the traffic spike, Quintero thought he'd found an audience on the other side of the world. I need to travel to China right now because I'm the bomb there, Quintero says he recalls thinking. But as soon as he dug into the data, he knew something was wrong. Google Analytics, a common tool used by website owners to parse web traffic, shows that all the Chinese visitors are from one specific city, Lanzhou. They are unlikely to be real humans because they stay on the page for an average of 0 seconds and don't scroll or click. Quintero quickly realized his website was actually being bombarded by bots. Quintero later found out from social media that he was far from the only website operator who started seeing a large influx of bots from China and Singapore beginning in September. A lifestyle magazine based in India, a blog about a small island off the coast of Canada, the owners of several personal portfolio websites, a weather forecast platform with over 15 million pages, e-commerce shops hosted by Spotify, and even domains run by the U.S. government have all reported being hit by what appeared to be the same bots. And they were easy to spot because the bots significantly skewed each website's usual analytics patterns. In the last 90 days, 14.7% of visits to U.S. government websites came from Lanzhou and 6.6% came from Singapore, making them the top two cities in the world supposedly hungry for information from the American government, according to analytics.usa.gov. While their IP addresses can be traced to China and Singapore, there's little information about who's actually behind this massive amount of automated visits. Website owners who are being targeted have largely concluded that the bots don't pose any immediate harm. Given that AI-related bot activity surged across the internet last year, many believe the traffic could be connected to companies harvesting web data for training models. Where is Lanzhou now anyway? When website owners saw the sudden uptick of visits from China, many of them started asking, where is Lanzhou? The second-tier city in China's northwest is known for its heavy manufacturing industries, and historical legacy as a Silk Road trading hub, but it's neither a tech hub nor home to significant numbers of data centers. So why is there so much traffic coming from the city? Lanzhou might not be the actual source of the bots, says Gavin King, founder of Known Agents, which analyzes automated online traffic. King's own company website has also been targeted by bots from China and Singapore. When he looked deeper into the specific details of the visits, the only thing he could say for certain was that all of the traffic was eventually being routed through Singapore. Google Analytics determined the visits originated from Lanzhou, but King says that could just be an educated guess instead of a precise location. But the most concrete detail King found is that the traffic is being routed through servers belonging to several major Chinese cloud companies. King says the bot traffic his website received all came from through the Autonomous System Number, ASN 132203, a unique identifier in the Internet's routing system assigned to an Internet service provider operated by the Chinese company Tencent. Andy, the manager of a large weather forecasting website group, says he detected bot traffic coming from ASN's associated with Tencent, Alibaba, and Huawei. He asked only to use his first to protect his privacy. All three companies are major cloud providers, and it's unclear whether the bots are coming from in-house or clients using their servers. Many people suspect that these bots are part of an AI company's effort to collect training data from web pages. In 2025, AI bots accounted for a significant portion of overall web traffic, which crawled the internet for text and other information to feed to data-hungry large language models. But there are some key differences between these Chinese bots and other AI bots. First, there's simply way more of them. King says on his website that the traffic from China and Singapore accounts for 22% of overall traffic, while all other AI bots account for less than 10% combined. Most leading AI companies clearly identify their bots to website operators, which also makes them easier to block. The frontier AI labs are not as interested in invading bot blocking rules, says Brent Maynard, senior editor of security, technology, and strategy at the internet infrastructure company Akamai. He says AI companies usually only start trying to disguise their bots after a website shuts the front door. This wave of Chinese bots, however, disguise themselves as normal human users from the start, and they have even bypassed common bot blocking rules, several website owners told Wired. Beyond AI companies, there are other businesses incentivized to scrape the internet, including search crawlers and intelligent gathering companies. Rising costs and distorted data. The good news, at least for now, is that the bots don't seem to have an explicitly malicious purpose. They haven't been publicly connected to any cyber attack and don't seem to be scanning for vulnerabilities. But the lack of a clear motive also adds to the confusion. Some website owners are worried that the bots are scanning copyrighted material without permission. Others say the surge has forced them to pay more for bandwidth, as bot traffic crowds out human users, or to invest in more sophisticated prevention tools. The visits also skew traffic analytics, distorting reports about who is actually visiting their sites. But the biggest impacts are felt by people who earn revenue from attracting ad clicks on their websites. This is destroying my AdSense strategies, says Quintero, the paranormal blog owner, because they are saying your website is only visited by bots, so your content is not something that is valuable to the viewer. As a result, websites like his may be seen as less desirable to advertisers and penalized by Google. Makeshift solutions. Many people have complained about the China AI bot problem in online support channels over the past few months, or sent messages about it directly to their web hosting providers. But so far, there are still few concrete answers. Contacted by Wired, WordPress acknowledged that it has seen reports in recent months that some of its sites are experiencing increased traffic from suspected AI bots or scrapers. WordPress websites have always had a great structure that makes them easy to find and be indexed by search engines. Those same capabilities make them easily crawled by AI as well, the company said in an unsigned email. Google, Cloudflare, and Squarespace did not respond to requests for comment. Some website operators are now taking matters into their own hands. On social platforms like Reddit, victims of the bots have swapped makeshift strategies for identifying and blocking them. Over time, they learn that these bots often present themselves as using old versions of Windows operating systems and uncommon screen aspect ratios, characteristics that allow website operators to block them as a group. If the websites don't care about traffic from China or Singapore at all, some also elect to prevent anyone with an IP address located in those countries from accessing their sites. Andy, the weather website manager, says he ended up blocking four ASNs associated with Tencent, Alibaba, and Huawei. That was enough to reduce the number of bots significantly, but not completely eliminate them, he says. The number of daily visits from the Chinese bots to his site have gone from 127,000 at their peak down to just above 2,000 the day he spoke to Wired. As autonomous AI tools proliferate across the internet, figuring out how to combat them will likely become a more common headache for website owners. This is the cost of being on the internet to some degree, says Akamai's Maynard. You're open and you're in public view. The fight over U.S. climate rules is just beginning. Molly Taff, source Wired. The Environmental Protection Agency is expected to roll back the endangerment finding, which underpins the U.S.'s ability to regulate the greenhouse gases that cause climate change. The rollback, the result of more than 15 years of work from right-wing special interest groups, represents the most aggressive move against climate regulation in the U.S. to date, and will introduce a lengthy fight that's almost certain to wind up in front of the Supreme Court. The move could also create significant legal and regulatory uncertainty for a wide swath of industries, from oil companies fighting state and local climate lawsuits to car companies attempting to plan production of new models in the midst of an ongoing legal fight. I don't see any plan, any strategy, any end game, says Pat Parentu, a professor of environmental law at Vermont Law and Graduate School. I don't see anything from this administration. Just F everything up as much as you can. You can print that. The Clean Air Act mandates that the EPA regulate any type of air pollution that might constitute a hazard to public health and welfare. The endangerment finding is a 2009 ruling that creates a scientific and legal basis for regulating greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. This finding is the bedrock for every climate-based regulation the agency has issued since, from restrictions on power plants to emission standards for cars. The original finding was mandated by a 2007 Supreme Court decision, Massachusetts versus EPA, in a case brought by the state against the Bush administration, challenging it for not taking action to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles. The Supreme Court ruled that greenhouse gases should be regulated under the Clean Air Act. Even before the endangerment finding officially came into existence, it was already a political football for right-wing interests. Following the Supreme Court decision, the Bush-era EPA sent an email to the White House linking six greenhouse gases to climate change and detailing a number of disparate impacts on public health and the environment. However, the White House refused to open the email to acknowledge the science and the finding, kicking the can down the road for nearly 2 years until the email was released in 2009 under the Obama administration. Right-wing groups, including the Heritage Foundation, the group behind the Project 2025 plan, have been vocal critics of the ruling and the EPA's actions on greenhouse gases for nearly two decades. As the New York Times reported on Monday, the Heritage Foundation funded a campaign in 2022 to help create regulatory documents that enabled the repeal of the endangerment finding. The endangerment finding has proven remarkably difficult for these groups to attack. Both of Trump's first EPA administrators declined to challenge the finding while they were in office, despite pressure from ideologues inside and out of that administration. This hesitancy was thanks in part to businesses supporting the original EPA ruling. Industry has generally been in favor of stability in this space, and having EPA maintain its regulatory authority, says Megan Greenfield, a former senior counsel at the EPA. The endangerment finding serves this really important purpose in providing a level playing field and acknowledging EPA's authority. A draft version of the rollback released this summer contained a myriad of arguments aimed at undermining the finding, including making the case that because greenhouse gas emissions are global, they should not be regulated under the Clean Air Act. The proposal pretty much threw spaghetti on the wall, says Rachel Cletus, a senior policy director at the Union of Concerned Scientists. There's just all kinds of arguments, all of them without merit. Clean Air Act arguments, science arguments, cost arguments. The draft rollback also attempted to attack the climate science and underpinning the endangerment finding, using a report produced by the Department of Energy and authored by five known climate contrarians over the course of a few months. As Wired reported, many scientists whose research was cited in the Doe report felt that their work was misused or misconstrued to make bad arguments about climate science. These scientific arguments, experts say, will also be particularly vulnerable if taken before a court, particularly since a judge ruled last month that the group that authored the report was put together illegally. I will eat my car if they get upheld on the science, says Parenteau. And at this point in time, we're out of time. Until next time.